are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Oles. Tonight on Right On Radio, I will be talking with Chris McKinney about his novel Midnight Water City, the first entry in a brilliant new sci-fi trilogy that explores the complex past of a murdered scientist deified in death through the eyes of a man who once committed unspeakable crimes for her. McKinney is an American writer born and raised in Hawaii. He has written six other novels. In the last part of the show, Josh talks with David Vine about his work, The United States of War, a provocative examination of how the U.S. military has shaped our entire world, from today's costly, endless wars to the prominence of violence in everyday American life. David Vine is professor of political anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio. Chris, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Welcome to Right On Radio. Thanks for spending some of your time with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. You want to start with a little description of the book and the reading that we have prepared?
Sure. So the new book is Midnight Water City, and it's pretty much, I mean, I guess you could say that it's pretty much starts off as a standard murder mystery, but it's set in the year 2142. Basically, a body is discovered, and it's the body of a deified scientist who 40 years before was credited with saving humanity. Structurally, the book is a whodunit that also forces the narrator to take a hard look at his own past. Setting-wise, it's speculative fiction. Instead of building in space, I imagine a future where we build under and on the ocean. Some major technological advancements besides the underwater cities includes something called an IE, which is basically a smartphone that we're connected to neurologically. And it's a small drone-like floating orb. And another piece of technology is what's called the AMP chamber, which extends lifespan through hibernation technology. The state of the world in 2142, the world is scarred by climate change and other catastrophes, and it's an eco-friendly place with some dystopian undertones. So as far as the reading, I'll read a passage that sort of more specifically describes this world, and it's at the beginning of chapter 6, so it's close to the beginning of the novel, and I'll start now. For the most part, the only people allowed to live on the south and east sides of the island are subsidized preservation workers who spend their days planting and caring for indigenous species or eradicating invasive ones. They're all neo-hippies required to live in primitive huts and tree houses designed to not ruin the natural aesthetic of the island. They live under rules kind of like town associations back in the day. They also run the theme park millions of tourists flock to while they're here on their pilgrimage to pay reverence from the side of the mountain to Akira's telescope, nicknamed the Savior's Eye. Its construction was a deal brokered by Akira. Maybe she'd chosen that spot for its clarity in viewing the stars, or maybe she'd chosen a spot that high up so she could limit access to her telescope. And to her. I was never sure. Most of us, the less thans, don't live on the island or on the low floors of the new seascrapers and the high floors of the old skyscrapers. We live in the float burbs, clusters of domed townhouses that bob on the ocean surface and descend two stories underwater. From above, they look like sinking flowers. The townhouses are magnetically moored far enough from the shore that they aren't an eyesore. Most government workers, plastic skimmers, trade people, coral gardeners, small business owners, and resort and theme park middle management, we live on means just enough to enable us to do nothing after we put in our 40 hours. maybe we can afford a once-a-month trip to the A&P clinic. Maybe we save and purchase a week-long family tour of Epcot or Lucky Cat City once a year. Maybe we collect enough Social Security to experience a mundane retirement after 80. Octogenarian boredom on a budget, or OBB as we call it. It's not great, but it's better than living on the continent. 300 million surrounding the quad state Great Leachate, the biggest landfill in the history of man. Penicillin rivers running like veins from Missouri to the Nashville Dam. We pretty much gave up on trying to clean that up. Figured it was easier to just come out here and start a vertical expansion. I'm hovering home through the satin gunmetal sky. I've just quit my job. I'm still reeling. I realize I forgot to take my insomnia and anxiety inhibitors. I have access to the kind a person is only supposed to take for space flight. I've been double dosing every day before I get home. The second dose curbs my anxiety about taking too many anxiety pills. A trip would be nice right about now. Not a once a week quickie family package, but maybe a long solo tour of something far away from the ocean, like pitching in a hand to replant Yosemite National Desert. I sigh. I haven't volunteered for anything my entire life except war. Besides, I couldn't keep a fern alive in a rainforest. It's too late for me now anyway. I dock my seal and step onto the wharf. I walk toward my unit across planks that light up as I go. The sun is setting and a man about 100 years old, a retired cryptocurrency assistant to some VP, is fishing in front of his slip, fishing in water too deep to bring up anything with that pathetic spool of line. Any luck, Fred? I ask as I walk by. Not yet, he says, legs dangling over the edge, his short-legged plaid foam fit humming cool air onto his skin while sweat drips down his face. Not ever, I think, poor guy. I pass him and hear the blaring of a neighbor's IE projection, probably a classic movie. From outside, it sounds like the kind of entertainment geared towards an old man, the main character of the program, an elderly badass with no romantic entanglements, just a retired guy on a mission using his skills to help other people. Said skills usually involve a remarkable proficiency to bloody his hands. It's the kind of show for a man whose capacity to dream is the only thing lower than his T levels. I pass the unit and begrudgingly head toward mine. Two units down, a group of teens on the same color tat pill, probably red because except for their outlines, I can't see them well. The fact that they're half naked and masked up like it's Halloween doesn't help. It's how the kids do nowadays, trying to collectively express their individuality. Hair smart gelled itself into fins, flower petals, and snakes. They ignore me as I approach, ignore everything outside of themselves, really, whispering empty secrets and doing everything else teens have always done, like talking about how dumb the world is, even though they haven't really had to look at it yet. If anyone undoes the work of Akira, it will be this generation, too young to remember Ascalon, to appreciate being alive. I pass them, practically a ghost in their eyes, and stand before my front door. The plank light under me is on the fritz again. I regret not taking my astronaut-grade anti-anxiety and insomnia pills. For all I know, the chief might have pinged Sabrina and told her that I quit.
All right. We are speaking with Chris McKinney, author of Midnight Water City. That was a reading from the book. Well, let's start with the question that I'm curious about. Every blurb and review that I have read indicates or suggests that you were influenced by Philip K. Dick and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep and Blade Runner, the movie that was caused by that, and Isaac Asimov. I'm wondering how you feel about these comparisons and if you feel they are accurate in the influences that you've had.
I would say that any comparison with that, I mean, it's flattering, if anything. As far as directly influencing me, I mean, maybe a little bit. I will admit that I loved Blade Runner as a kid. But it wasn't conscious. It wasn't, sort of I wasn't dwelling on it while I was writing the book. The fact that there's Japanese aspects of Japanese culture infused in the book is not a Blade Runner thing. It's a I'm part Japanese thing.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, when you have Japanese heritage and you live in, you were born and raised in Hawaii. I mean, Japanese stuff is all around you your entire life because there's still just so many people of Japanese descent on this island. So I would say that aspect, though I can see how those comparisons can be made. Blade Runner isn't though I love Blade Runner, Blade Runner isn't the reason why that stuff exists in this book.
The noir aspect, it's very interesting. A lot of science fiction is not really noir. This I consider to be science fiction noir. And I'm wondering what your ideas were around that. If you really wanted it to be as noir as it is, or if it just came out that way when you were writing it. What's up with that?
I think that, you know, because I've never, this is my first attempt at speculative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I needed certain things to tether me to, you know, to what I'm used to. Just a couple of things. And one was the ocean. You know, I grew up around the ocean, in the ocean. So, you know, I'm very comfortable with that. Another thing is noir. So in some of my previous books, it's sort of what I would consider my genre, but it's, you know, but you know, some of my other books are basically noir fiction set in Hawaii. So I feel comfortable with noir, feel comfortable with the ocean. And like I mentioned before, that's sort of, I needed those tethers in order to feel comfortable pursuing this thing that I've never tried to do before.
Well, you certainly have created a fascinating culture and a fascinating story about a lot about water and about the ocean and about another thing that I noticed was it's kind of under the surface, but the whole thing about a past of climate change. And with our situation with climate change right now, I'm wondering if you could sort of compare and contrast what is really going on now and what happened in your culture that you have created.
Yeah, well, it's sort of interesting because, you know, when I was doing the world building, one thing that I went into it, the idea that I consciously kept repeating in my head is that, remember that the future is unpredictable. Experts make wild mistakes when they try to predict what the world will look like 20 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now. So I didn't want what's happening with climate change to be that linear and predictable. Some of it, yeah, but what actually, there's other catastrophes that are possible. So in this novel, one thing that happens is a sun flare that knocks electricity out, on a global scale. But the climate crisis is, there's definitely that aspect in this book. I think that a lot of people rightfully fear what will happen as, you know, sea levels rise on like an island that I live on or in coastal areas. In this book, I actually sort of flip it and said that a lot of the bad stuff that can happen through climate change can actually happen in the interior of continents too. So that's what I tried to create with the Great Lachate, which is basically, if you can imagine this, you know, this polluted landfill in the middle of continental North America. So it's just sort of like trying to, you know, going into it, realizing that you can't predict the future. So maybe don't, you know, do something different, anticipate or guess at something different than experts would. And then you might have a better chance of actually nailing it.
Yeah, I live in Minnesota, and I was appalled at the concept of garbage all over the Midwest. Yeah. I was like, oh, that could happen, I thought to myself. You know, we have these ideas that we think are going to happen, and they may not be the things that happen at all, you know. Garbage in the Midwest.
Yeah, it's like the sequence, right? It's sort of like, you know, we can maybe predict all of the troubling things that can occur through the course of this crisis, but we can't necessarily predict the sequence of what happens first, what happens next. The one thing that I will say is that I wrote this thing actually before the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
but even then I was thinking about the idea that isn't it just human nature to like do something either at the nick of time or when it's already too late?
Yes.
You know what I mean? So it's sort of like I created this world that has felt the effects of global warming, but because once it sort of hit the world, then they started trying to do something about it. So it's a scarred world, but it's not an apocalyptic world.
Talk some about your concept of the, well, it isn't an asteroid, is it? It's like a thing of trash? Or is it an asteroid? I couldn't tell. But anyway, talk about the asteroid and where you got that idea and how the Earth was saved from that item.
I think that it's sort of, I'm not afraid of tropes, I guess. It's just sort of like, okay, you know, the world's gonna end. What am I gonna do? Should I try to create something completely original and different, or just acknowledge the fact that it is scientifically possible that an asteroid will hit this Earth and lay waste to humanity? There have been asteroids that have hit this planet in the past. So I try not to overthink it, because the asteroid really isn't the story. It's the past. And the asteroid itself isn't really about it, it's, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but it's sort of like all I needed was that device that, okay, the world, our world almost ended, and I didn't want to build something super elaborate, because this story is about 40 years sort of after those events.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings me to the whole cult of personality that you kind of bring out. There's Akira. She's both a real, genuine hero and also a flawed human, maybe very flawed human. And there's other people. Your unnamed narrator also is kind of I don't know if he's a cult of personality in the sense of being famous, but he certainly has done good things and is also a flawed human being. Would you talk about those concepts for me?
Sure. I mean, it's really, I mean, Akira is, I would say, is sort of the star of this story. Much like maybe Ahab or Gatsby, or, you know, she's the narrator is sort of in proximity of her. And he helps her, but she's sort of, you know, she is the thing. She's whatever. She's the Hannibal Lecter of this story, I guess. And I don't, it's just, I think that part of, I mean, thematically, that what I think about often is just, and it's not a profound sort of theme, but power is kind of scary. And I think that, you know, has anybody who wielded power ever done it always humanely or perfectly? And I would say not that I know of. Power is just so dangerous. And I think that both of those characters sort of reflect that idea that to have power is to sometimes destroy.
Well, let's talk about history. I've got this, towards the very end of the book, the narrator talks about the past affecting the present. Obviously, that's true. And the present affecting the future. But he talks about how they kind of, this isn't his word, but they kind of mush together in terms of what predicts what and what affects what and how things can even change based on thinking even about the concept that if you observe something, it changes it. And I'm wondering how you came up with that concept. Very complicated and fascinating concept.
Yeah. Well, it's just, I think that while I was doing research for this book, some of the things that I was reading about was, one was particle physics, right? So, I'm reading about particle physics and, you know, how a particle will behave differently, whether it's if it's observed or unobserved. And I also, you know, I did reading on time. And, you know, I'm thinking about the notion of time as not just this very simple linear thing. I explore these ideas more in the following books. So, you know, this is a book one of a trilogy. And so this is sort of kickstarting those ideas. And I explore them more in the second and third book.
Can you share, without spoilers, a little bit about the second and third book?
Sure. I would say that, so this, you know, the first book is, so I, not only, I, you know, so it's, this first book is very much, as you said, it's steeped in mystery and noir. And I'm continuing the same story, and I'm sort of shifting, I guess, the genre, you could say. So I would say that the second book, for example, is more adventure than mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a little bit of elements of horror. And in the third book, I do other things as well. So I've always been sort of fascinated, you know, some of my favorite books are these books where you can tell that the author is just stuffing everything that they love and find fascinating into a book or a series of books. And it's these crazy worlds. And, you know, I've always been enamored by that. So I guess this trilogy is my attempt to do the same thing. I'm just cramming this world, this story with just all the things that I love and all the things that I don't love and the things that fascinate me about people and the world and possible futures.
Well, at least so far you have crammed things in very well. I really enjoyed this book
a
lot.
Thank you very much.
I kind of couldn't put it down. I was at least, you know, in the middle of the night sort of dozing off and then going, I got to wake up and read this book. You know, I was sort of...
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it was
great
fun.
Great to hear.
Tell us how people can get a hold of you and do you have a website? I tried to find a website and I couldn't find one, but I found lots of Facebook and things. So
yeah.
How can people get a hold of you and find out more about you?
Yeah, I just, you know, the book does have a website, and the website is watercitytrilogy.com. As far as getting a hold of me, I'm thankfully late Reed's game. So I do have, you know, I did start up an account, that, you know, before this book came out, and so I check in on that from time to time. And you know, it's easy to find me on Facebook. You know, if people want to message me, that's fine. But yeah, so the website for the book is poking my head in Goodreads and my sort of baby account, my new account, and Facebook and Instagram. No Twitter though. It's just too much.
It's too much.
I can do maybe manage social media wise. I can, you know, do two out of the three, but three, you know, I have a Twitter account, but it became overwhelming.
I agree. Well, we've been speaking with Chris McKinney, author of Midnight Water City, a wonderful book. You should read it. And thanks a lot. It was a wonderful interview, and we've enjoyed speaking to you. Thanks for taking a spot out of here. It's afternoon there, isn't it? You're in Hawaii?
I am in Hawaii, and it's 2:30 in the afternoon, and the sun is up, and it's hot.
Yes. I was out at the ball game, and it was not hot here in Minnesota. So, but anyway, yeah. Thanks for spending part of your afternoon with us here on Right on Radio.
No problem. Well, I'll say this, I really want to go to Minnesota one day. And one of the biggest reasons why is I'm a huge Prince fan. I got to see Paisley Park. I have to get,
it is pretty amazing.
I'll make that happen soon. Yeah.
We've got murals down at First Avenue, and you can get t-shirts and whatever you want up here.
I'd love to see that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Chris, well, I'm going to let you go, but thank you very much. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you, Liz. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Bye-bye. And now this.
Today, I am talking with political anthropologist David Vine about his newest book, United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State. The book was a finalist for the 2020 LA Times Book Prize in History. David's other writings have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, The Guardian, Mother Jones, Boston Globe, Huffington Post, and The Chronicle of Higher Education, among others. All royalties from David's books and all speaker honorariums are donated to the Chagossian people and nonprofit organizations serving other victims of war. David, welcome to Right on Radio.
Thank you so much, Josh. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, so I said that right, Chagossians. Is that okay?
Yeah.
I looked up ahead of time. So my first question actually is about this. So concerning the royalties of your books, I wasn't familiar with the background of the Chagossian people before reading your bio and discovering way later into the reading of the United States of War, it was a subject of your first book, I believe. Right. Can you discuss their history a bit about being evicted from the island of Diego Garcia?
Sure. And yeah, in some ways, in many ways, my new book, The United States of War, really is an outgrowth of 19 years of research that began with being introduced to the Chagossians. Like most people in the United States, and sadly most people in the world, I knew nothing about the Chagossian people. This is a group of people who lived on islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean, islands called the Chagos Islands, since around the time of the American Revolution. And in the 1960s and 1970s, the entire group of people was rounded up and forcibly removed from their islands and their homes by the US and British governments, so the US military could build what has become a massive US Air Force and Navy base. And the people were simply deported, left in exile, 1,200 miles away, given no resettlement assistance for years and years and years. Unsurprisingly, they became deeply impoverished. And now for more than half a century, they've been struggling to go back home and to receive some decent compensation for what they've suffered. And this being introduced to the Chagossians, being asked by some of their lawyers to do some research as part of lawsuits they were bringing against the US and British governments, really opened my eyes to the huge collection of military bases that the United States has maintained around the world since independence, but even at a greater global scale since World War II, and opened my eyes to the effects of these bases and the larger system of war that they are a foundation of.
So that's a great segue into my next question here. In the preface, you quote the scholar Nikhil Pal Singh that the people of the United States have arguably never been at peace. Now, with your background as a political anthropologist, I was initially curious if you could elaborate on his points. I was going to ask if you could think, how do you think about our culture, if it's a blame for why we seek out conflicts? But then in the introduction, though, you directly answer this, though, saying that it's the infrastructure that makes wars carried out by the United States possible, not to blame. Is that fair to say?
Yes, although I go a bit farther. I do very much think the system of war that the United States has engaged in since independence, the system of war that U.S. elite leaders have built, is not the problem is not a cultural one. It's an economic one, it's a political one, it's a military one. There are social ideological dimensions, the degree to which militarism is really a religion in the United States and has been increasingly since independence. But what I say about bases is that not only do bases abroad, meaning bases outside US borders, not only have they enabled a long series of wars, but they've actually made war more likely. So since independence, this is what I argue and found after 19 years of research for my book, The United States War, that since independence, the US government has been building military bases abroad, building extraterritorial military bases, initially on Native American people's lands outside the 13 original states, and then increasingly on a global scale, reached new levels during and after World War II, as I mentioned. And what we see through US history is that these bases, again, not just enabled wars, but actually made wars more likely, where wars often led to the creation of new US military bases abroad, which then led to new wars, which then led to new bases, which led to new wars in a repeating pattern over time. Which is not to say that anything about this is inevitable. In fact, much of the impetus for my book, The United States of War, is to argue and encourage us to choose a different path. There are wars that US leaders avoided in the past. US leaders can avoid war now, and first and foremost need to bring the current wars that the United States is engaged in to an end. And that's really why I wrote the book, because I think, in short, we need to stop fighting. The United States has fought a long series of wars, back to Singh's quotation. The United States has fought in virtually every year in its history in some form of war or combat. In the last 20 years, we've been fighting a long, continuous series of wars, the endless wars or forever war. We need to stop fighting. And if we don't, I think we are really doomed as a country.
The one fact I want to bring up here, and I don't want to forget about that, I'm just going to say that you bring up the book, is that there is, I believe, 800 military bases spread out across 85 countries that are still operating today. And the U.S. government has built the largest collection of military bases occupying foreign lands in world history.
Yeah, thank you for providing that context. Again, the U.S. military has been building bases outside U.S. borders since independence, but in the post-World War II era, this collection of bases has reached a new global scale and, as you said, has exceeded the size of any collection of foreign military bases of any power, empire, people, country, and world history. And this, again, is part of the infrastructure of war. And part of my fear right now in particular, the US has been closing bases in Afghanistan and withdrawing most, but not all, of its troops from Afghanistan. Part of my fear is, in a way, that withdrawal, it's important and a good sign and a good start, but the larger infrastructure of war in surrounding countries in the greater Middle East and on a global scale remains in place. And if we don't change that infrastructure of war, if we don't change some of the underlying economic systems related to in particular to the military-industrial complex, we are likely to just continue fighting wars, continue the wars that are already underway, and get into even more catastrophic wars. That's my greatest fear.
So let's talk about the cost of this right now. The dollar figure you give in the book is there's $6.4 trillion is estimated what taxpayers have spent or should expect to eventually pay for post-9/11 wars, along with the cost for future veteran benefits, interest payments on money borrowed to pay for these wars. You already kind of answered this, but I want you to go a little more detailed. Do you predict we'll see a repurposing of those funds for other concerns now with pandemic preparedness or green deals in the future, or are you cynical about the future?
I'm definitely not cynical about the future. I think the future is in our hands. There are some powerful people whose hands also have a role in shaping the future, meaning U.S. political leaders, military leaders, civilian leaders, and of course, the leaders of weapons manufacturers and other elements of the military-industrial complex. And that's what we're up against. But we simply must change the course that we're on. We have to stop fighting. We have to change this system of war. As you pointed out, and that figure, $6.4 trillion, trillion with a T, is the money that has been spent on the global war on terror since 2001. And that comes from the Costs of War Project, which I recommend to everyone. It's been documenting the human and financial costs of the post-9/11 wars, and really doing work that the US government should be doing. But I encourage everyone to check out the Cost of War Project. Now we're talking really closer to $7 trillion, because that figure was from almost a year ago, $7 trillion. And we should think about, you know, in addition to the millions of deaths that these wars have brought to the peoples of Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, Libya, and on, as well as, of course, to U.S. military personnel. In addition to those deaths, how many deaths have we seen in the United States because of what we didn't invest $7 trillion in? We didn't invest $7 trillion in pandemic preparedness, as you said. How many hundreds of thousands of deaths could we have prevented if we had used just a tiny portion of that money to prepare for pandemics, to create adequate PPE supplies, to create an adequate and functioning public health system, to create universal healthcare? We could have. US leaders chose not to, beginning with the initial decision by the George W. Bush administration to wage war in response to the attacks of 9/11. We're coming up on the 20th anniversary of the attacks of 9/11. And we need to remember that nothing that followed was inevitable. The George W. Bush administration could have responded to those attacks in many ways. It should have responded to them as the crimes that they were, and responded with a criminal justice and intelligence gathering response. And research shows around the world that in responding to terrorist acts, responses rooted in criminal justice and intelligence gathering are far more effective than war. The George W. Bush administration chose war. Subsequent administrations chose war. And we are dealing with the consequences, and the world is dealing with the consequences. And that's what we need to change. We need to stop this permanent war that the United States has been embarking on since 2001.
I want to change gears now. I want to ask you about the opening of the book. You talk about how you don't want to use conventional names for wars. A more accurate rendering of the Spanish-American War, for example, you would say would be the Spanish-Cuban-Puerto Rican-Philippine-American War. Can you discuss why you choose to avoid oversimplifying names for conflicts?
Yeah, I think in a way it goes, I'm really glad you asked that question, which I think you're the first person, because it goes to the heart of my book. I wrote this book to encourage readers to think differently about U.S. history, to think differently about the United States. The process of doing the research for and writing the book changed how I see the United States. It was a process of really re-educating myself and stripping away some of the myths that I grew up with about US history and about US wars in particular. US wars, of course, have generally been celebrated. They've been seen as things to be celebrated, and the heroes of wars are ones that we've been taught to celebrate. There's really nothing we should celebrate about wars. Wars are first and foremost death and destruction and injury. There's very little that should be celebrated about war to begin with. But changing the names that we associate with different wars was a way to encourage people to think differently about the wars whose names we have in our consciousness often here in the United States. And we have sort of fixed ideas about those wars. So changing the names was a way to encourage people to think differently about each individual war and about the larger pattern of war.
I was impressed with your focus on specific individuals and groups or political agents responsible for certain actions instead of referring to the United States writ large. How conscientious are you while writing to use language that won't obscure uncomfortable truths? You already touched on this, but I'd ask it still.
Yeah, I think it's really important. So, and wars are a good example. One of the ones that troubles me most, and I haven't really figured out a good alternative, is the term Cold War. You know, people use the term Cold War to describe this decades-long conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union. There was nothing cold about this war. Millions of people died in this war. Proxy wars between the United States and Soviet Union, largely in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and Southeast Asia, in Korea, and in parts of Africa, millions upon millions of people died. Tens of millions were injured. How can we rightly call this a Cold War? And by doing so, we obscure all that death and suffering. So that's one example. And military discussions of military matters and wars so often obscure, as you said, and hide the truths of war and the central truth that war is about death. It's about killing. And I wanted another major aim of my book in telling the long history of US wars to make the human consequences of war front and center. And language is one way to start with that.
There's a cognitive dissonance, I think, for many Americans trying to imagine or consider the US as an empire on a global scale. I mean, for me, when you put that in perspective, I thought about that. It's something I never really considered, I guess. The term you use in the book is that we're an empire in denial. We largely designed the post-World War II international political economic system. We have unparalleled control over the United Nations. What makes the United States an empire, I guess, for our listening audience who aren't really familiar or haven't really thought of the United States in that way?
Yeah, again, I grew up not thinking of the United States as an empire. You know, I grew up in sort of the Star Wars generation. Now, I guess we have many generations of Star Wars fans, but the original Star Wars series, where I grew up relating to of the rebellion rather than the empire that they were fighting against, and thinking that the United States was like the rebels. When, of course, the United States was the empire. In fact, George Lucas was inspired by the U.S. war in Vietnam, where we very much were the empire. But to get to the heart of your question, you know, how else could we describe a country that began occupying a small group of states on the eastern seaboard of the United States, of what is now the United States of North America, and then expanded all the way across the continent, conquering territory and peoples and killing millions in the process, displacing tens of millions in the process? What other word is appropriate to describe that alone other than empire? So that's the beginning. The United States has been an empire since independence. Early leaders modeled the United States after the European empires and saw the United States as a rising empire in the Western Hemisphere. And in the post-World War II period, the United States has become a fundamentally different kind of empire. And you were alluding to this. It's become a global empire. The United States was largely an empire on more of a hemispheric scale prior to that. But in the post-World War II period, the United States has become an empire that both dominates large swaths of territory, mostly in North America, but pieces of territory elsewhere, and then has become an empire of bases. The bases, this collection of now about 750 bases abroad, are in a way like the colonies of old. They are discrete pieces of territory, much smaller pieces of territory, that actually allow the United States to dominate and influence and exert control over much larger swaths of territory. And that's why military bases are a foundation of contemporary U.S. empire, along with other foundations like controlling nuclear weapons and having by far the largest military budget in the world, among other elements of U.S. imperial power.
Hello, everyone. I am here to talk with David Vine about his book, The United States of War. So, Dave, I want you to describe for me the lease arrangement that the United States made with Cuba for Guantanamo Bay. It's a very unique arrangement.
It is. It was imposed on the Cuban people. The U.S. government, shortly after the war between Spain and the United States, and the United States effectively turned Cuba into a quasi-colony. Officially, Cuba had its independence from Spain, but the United States government retained tremendous control, including the right to invade and deploy troops into Cuba at will. Another part of the treaty that was imposed on the Cuban government and the Cuban people was the right for the U.S. government to create a military base at Guantanamo Bay. And this treaty was subsequently in the 1930s revised. But to this day, the United States occupies Guantanamo Bay against the will of the Cuban people. Cuba can't, by virtue of the treaty, remove the United States. It's a very odd arrangement where technically, in some ways, the United States is a tenant at Guantanamo Bay, but they essentially have a lease that every renter, every tenant would love to have where they can't be evicted. And the only way to evict the U.S. military would be to do it militarily, which the Cuban military and government isn't about to do. So as I say in the book, Guantanamo Bay should be considered a colony of the United States. It is a colonized piece of Cuba.
For our listening audience, I was wondering if you could explain this concept of open door imperialism, especially in relation to Mexico and Central America.
Yeah, open door imperialism does point to sort of another pattern and period in the history of U.S. empire and the history of U.S. imperialism that emerges around the turn of the 19th to 20th century. At that time, European empires and the United States were competing for the Chinese market and were using their militaries to make inroads into the Chinese market. And not just the United States, but European empires practiced what was called open door imperialism that involved the discrete holding of territory in China, small sort of city or even within a city settlements that enabled the power to exert its economic control into the Chinese market, rather than the wide scale seizure of Chinese territory, which would be sort of more traditional form of imperialism. So the United States government proceeds to practice this kind of open door imperialism, this kind of economic imperialism, not just in China, but indeed in Latin America, and particularly in Mexico and Central America, which after the United States invaded its other neighbor, Mexico, which it did on at least 10 occasions. But in the war, we just passed the 150th anniversary of the war with Mexico. The United States government and US corporations continued to exercise a tremendous amount of control over Mexico and the Mexican economy. And this sort of open door economic form of imperialism continued into the 20th century.
My last question for you, David, what are you working on next? Or what are you working on right now?
I'm working on some writing related to the book. Specifically, I want to write about alternatives, ways to make sure that we stop fighting. One of the things I'm writing about is a return to President Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's good neighbor policy. This is one of the rare periods in U.S. history when the U.S. military was not fighting, between 1935 and 1940, roughly. Roosevelt's good neighbor policy was premised on the belief that countries had no right to invade other countries, that countries had no right to intervene in the foreign or domestic policy of other countries. In point of fact, the U.S. track record in this period was more complicated, but the principles underlying this good neighbor policy are ones that we should return to, beginning with giving up any thought or right to invade and wage war in other countries. So that is one priority, as well as spelling out other ways to reduce the power of the military-industrial complex and change the course of the United States away from this system of permanent war. I do one other thing want to do is create a series of TikTok videos rather than just writing. I'm interested in sharing my ideas and thoughts on these matters of war and peace through TikTok and reaching a different audience.
I'd love to see that. So, and on a related note, I want to also share with a lot of people here who are listening that I think on the website for this book, there's a lot of great illustrations that are in this book. I think it's 28 illustrations that encompass and show the different base locations we have that our country occupies right now in different spots. Is that correct?
That's right. 28 maps specifically that show depict the history of U.S. wars, depict the collection of U.S. military bases abroad currently and historically, as well as illustrate other aspects of the book. And indeed, all the maps are available for free download on my website, which is davidvine.net.
Yeah, I'd recommend checking those out, and also recommend checking out David Vine's new book, United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State. David, once again, thanks for being on Red on Radio with us.
Josh, thank you so much. It's really been a great conversation.
And now this.
You have been listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds, and I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, David Devine and Chris McKinney, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast found on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now, stay tuned after these short messages for Bonjour, Minnesota.